Chapter 37. "What's that?" he suddenly exclaimed, hearing a rustle, and they both looked up. They were surrounded by dusky forms between 4 and 5 feet high, standing a few paces beyond the rays of the lantern. A moment's inspection revealed that the encircling figures were eavesdroppers, their heads being all towards the players, at whom they gazed intently. "Whoosh!" said Wiltov, and the whole 40 or 50 animals at once turned and galloped away. Play was again resumed. 10 minutes passed away. Then a large death's head moth advanced from the obscure outer air, wheeled twice round the lantern, flew straight at the candle, and extinguished it by the force of the blow. Wiltov had just thrown, but had not lifted the box, to see what he had cast, and now it was impossible. "What the infernal," he shrieked. "Ah, what shall we do? Perhaps I have thrown 6. Have you any matches?" "None," said Ven. "Christian had some. I wonder where he is. Christian." But there was no reply to Wiltov's shout, save a mournful whining from the herons which were nesting lower down the vale. Both men looked blankly round without rising. As their eyes grew accustomed to the darkness, they perceived faint greenish points of light among the grass and fern. These lights dotted the hillside like stars of a low magnitude. "Ah, glowworms," said Wiltov. "8 a minute. We can continue the game." Ven sat still, and his companion went hither and thither till he had gathered 13 glowworms, as many as he could find in a space of 4 or 5 minutes, upon a foxglove leaf which he pulled for the purpose. The red omen vented a low humorous laugh when he saw his adversary return with these. "Edderman to go on, then?" he said dryly. "I always am," said Wiltov angrily. And shaking the glowworms from the leaf, he ranged them with a trembling hand in a circle on the stone, leaving a space in the middle for the descent of the dice box, over which the 13 tiny lamps threw a pale phosphoric shine. The game was again renewed. It happened to be that season of the year at which glowworms put forth their greatest brilliancy, and the light they yielded was more than ample for the purpose, since it is possible on such nights to read the handwriting of a letter by the light of 2 or 3. The incongruity between the men's deeds and their environment was great. Amid the soft, juicy vegetation of the hollow in which they sat, the motionless and the uninhabited solitude, intruded the chink of guineas, the rattle of dice, the exclamations of the reckless players. Wiltov had lifted the box as soon as the lights were obtained, and the solitary die proclaimed that the game was still against him. "I won't play any more. You've been tampering with the dice," he shouted. "How when they were your own?" said the red omen. "We'll change the game. The lowest point shall win the stake. It may cut off my ill luck. Do you refuse?" "No, go on," said Ven. "Oh, there they are again, damn them," cried Wiltov, looking up. The eavescroppers had returned noiselessly, and were looking on with erect heads just as before, their timid eyes fixed upon the scene, as if they were wondering what mankind and candlelight could have to do in these haunts at this untoward hour. "What a plague those creatures are staring at me so," he said, and flung a stone, which scattered them, when the game was continued as before. Wiltov had now 10 guineas left, and each laid 5. Wiltov threw 3 points, then 2, and raked in the coins. The other seized the die, and clenched his teeth upon it in sheer rage, as if he would bite it in pieces. "Never give in. Here are my last 5, he cried, throwing them down. "Hang the glowworms, they are going out. Why don't you burn, you little fools? Stir them up with a thorn." He probed the glowworms with a bit of stick, and rolled them over, till the bright side of their tails was upwards. "There's light enough. Throw on," said Ven. Wiltov brought down the box within the shining circle and looked eagerly. He had thrown ace. "Well done. I said it would turn, and it has turned." Ven said nothing, but his hand shook slightly. He threw ace also. "Oh," said Wiltov. "Erse me." The die smacked the stone a second time. It was ace again. Ven looked gloomy, threw the die, was seen to be lying in 2 pieces, the cleft sides uppermost. "I've thrown nothing at all," he said. Serves me right, I split the die with my teeth. Here, take your money. Blank is less than one. I don't wish it. Take it, I say you've won it. And we'll go through the stakes against the red omen's chest. Then gathered them up, arose, and withdrew from the hollow, Wildov sitting stupefied. When he had come to himself, he also arose, and, with the extinguished lantern in his hand, went towards the high road. On reaching it, he stood still. The silence of night pervaded the whole heath except in one direction, and that was towards Miss Tover. There he could hear the noise of light wheels, and presently saw two caryatulumps descending the hill. Wildov screened himself under a bush and waited. The vehicle came on and passed before him. It was a hired carriage, and behind the coachman were two persons whom he knew well. There sat Eustacia and Eobright, the arm of the latter being round her waist. They turned the sharp corner at the bottom towards the temporary home which Klim had hired and furnished, about 5 miles to the eastward. Wildov forgot the loss of the money at the sight of his lost love, whose preciousness in his eyes was increasing in geometrical progression with each new incident that reminded him of their hopeless division. Brimming with the subtilized misery that he was capable of feeling, he followed the opposite way towards the inn. About the same moment that Wildov stepped into the highway, Van also had reached it at a point 100 yards further on, and he, hearing the same wheels, likewise waited till the carriage should come up. When he saw who sat there, he seemed to be disappointed. Reflecting a minute or two, during which interval the carriage rolled on, he crossed the road, and took a short cut through the firs and heath to a point where the turnpike road bent round in ascending a hill. He was now again in front of the carriage, which presently came up at a walking pace. Van stepped forward and showed himself. Eustacia started when the lamp shone upon him, and Klim's arm was involuntarily withdrawn from her waist. He said, "What, Diggory? You are having a lonely walk." "Yes, I beg your pardon for stopping you," said Van. "But I am waiting about for Mrs. Wildov. I have something to give her from Mrs. Eobright. Can you tell me if she's gone home from the party yet?" "No. But she will be leaving soon. You may possibly meet her at the corner." Van made a farewell obeisance, and walked back to his former position, where the byroad from Miss Tover joined the highway. Here he remained fixed for nearly half an hour, and then another pair of lights came down the hill. It was the old-fashioned wheeled nondescript belonging to the captain, and Thomason sat in it alone, driven by Charlie. The red omen came up as they slowly turned the corner. "I beg pardon for stopping you, Mrs. Wildov," he said. "But I have something to give you privately from Mrs. Eobright." He handed a small parcel. It consisted of the 100 guineas he had just won, roughly twisted up in a piece of paper. Thomason recovered from her surprise, and took the packet. "That's all, ma'am, I wish you good night," he said, and vanished from her view. Thus Van, in his anxiety to rectify matters, had placed in Thomason's hands not only the 50 guineas which rightly belonged to her, but also the 50 intended for her cousin Klim. His mistake had been based upon Wildov's words at the opening of the game, when he indignantly denied that the guinea was not his own. It had not been comprehended by the red omen that at halfway through the performance the game was continued with the money of another person, and it was an error which afterwards helped to cause more misfortune than treble the loss in money value could have done. The night was now somewhat advanced, and Van plunged deeper into the heath, till he came to a ravine, where his van was standing a spot not more than 200 yards from the site of the gambling bout. He entered this movable home of his, lit his lantern, and, before closing his door for the night, stood reflecting on the circumstances of the preceding hours. While he stood, the dawn grew visible in the northeast quarter of the heavens, which, the clouds having cleared off, was bright with a soft sheen at this midsummer time, though it was only between 1 and 2 o'clock. Van, thoroughly weary, then shut his door, and flung himself down to sleep. Book 4, The Closed Door, Won the rencounter by the pool, the July sun shone over Egdon, and fired its crimson ether to scarlet. It was the one season of the year, and the one weather of the season, in which the heath was gorgeous. This flowering period represented the second, or noontide division in the cycle of those superficial changes which alone were possible here. It followed the green, or young fern period, representing the morn, and preceded the brown period, when the heath bells and ferns would wear the russet tinges of evening, to be in turn displaced by the dark hue of the winter period, representing night. Clym and Eustacia, in their little house at Alderworth, beyond East Egdon, were living on with a monotony which was delightful to them. The heath and changes of weather were quite blotted out from their eyes for the present. They were enclosed in a sort of luminous mist, which hid from them surroundings of any inharmonious color, and gave to all things the character of light. When it rained they were charmed, because they could remain indoors together all day with such a show of reason. When it was fine they were charmed, because they could sit together on the hills. They were like those double stars which revolve round and round each other, and from a distance, appear to be one. The absolute solitude in which they lived, intensified their reciprocal thoughts. Yet some might have said, that it had the disadvantage of consuming their mutual affections at a fearfully prodigal rate. Eobright did not fear for his own part, but recollection of Eustacia's old speech about the evanescence of love, now apparently forgotten by her, sometimes caused him to ask himself a question, and he recoiled at the thought that the quality of finiteness was not foreign to Eden. When 3 or 4 weeks had been passed thus, Eobright resumed his reading in earnest. To make up for lost time he studied indefatigably, for he wished to enter his new profession with the least possible delay. Now, Eustacia's dream had always been that, once married to Clym, she would have the power of inducing him to return to Paris. He had carefully withheld all promise to do so, but would he be proof against her coaxing and argument? S. He had calculated to such a degree on the probability of success, that S. He had represented Paris, and not Budmouth, to her grandfather as in all likelihood their future home. Her hopes were bound up in this dream. In the quiet day since their marriage, when Eobright had been poring over her lips, her eyes, and the lines of her face, S. He had mused and mused on the subject, even while in the act of returning his gaze. And now the sight of the books, indicating a future which was antagonistic to her dream, struck her with a positively painful jar. She was hoping for the time when, as the mistress of some pretty establishment, however small, near a Parisian boulevard, she would be passing her days on the skirts at least of the gay world, and catching stray wafts from those town pleasures she was so well fitted to enjoy. Yet Eobright was as firm in the contrary intention, as if the tendency of marriage were rather to develop the fantasies of young philanthropy than to sweep them away. Her anxiety reached a high pitch, but there was something in Clem's undeviating manner which made her hesitate, before sounding him on the subject. At this point in their experience, however, an incident helped her. It occurred one evening about 6 weeks after their union, and arose entirely out of the unconscious misapplication of one of the 50 guineas intended for Eobright. A day or two after the receipt of the money Thomason had sent a note to her aunt to thank her. S. He had been surprised at the largeness of the amount, but as no sum. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.